we've created a world that has 300 exabytes of information.
You're listening to Speakers Forum. I'm your host, Jenny Cecil Moore.
If you don't know what an exabyte is, don't feel bad. This is a new number they had to invent because they didn't have numbers big enough. It's a 300 followed by 18 zeros. And we've created more information, more human-made information in the last 5 years than in all of human history before it.
In this web-only episode, neuroscientist Daniel Levitin gives some tips on how to help your brain manage information. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle about his book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload.
Because I'm a scientist, I like to form my opinions based on data and evidence when they're available. And so I'm going to start with some numbers. People say it's an age of information overload, but you should be skeptical of such a claim. Is that true? What data do we possibly have for this? Well, people have been doing studies, people in information sciences departments and in big companies like Google and Amazon. And here are some numbers just to get you thinking. The average American took in 5 times as much information every day last year compared to 1986. 5 times as much information last year than 1986 every day, which is the equivalent of reading 175 newspapers from cover to cover. In our leisure time, we process 34 gigabytes of information. We've created a world that has 300 exabytes of information. If you don't know what an exabyte is, don't feel bad. This is a new number they had to invent because they didn't have numbers big enough. It's a 300 followed by 18 zeros. And we've created more information, more human-made information in the last 5 years than in all of human history before it. If just your share, one person's share of that information, was placed on little 3x5 index cards, it would cover all of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. And if you were to go grocery shopping in 1976, you went to the supermarket, you would have found, on average, there were 9,000 unique products at the grocery store. Today, that same grocery store has 40,000 unique products, more than 4 times as many products. And because the average American gets most of their shopping done in just 150 items, every time you go grocery shopping, you have to ignore 39,850 items. Now, just to drive home the point about why this is information overload, in 1976, there was really a very small milk section. There might have been 2 kinds of milk, regular milk and skim milk. And, you know, Cheerios, there was 1 kind. Now, as you know, there's 4 or 5 or 6 kinds of Cheerios. Where I shop, there's an entire section of milk that, you know, is bigger than the cereal aisle used to be. And when you're shopping, if you know what you want, say you want regular old Cheerios, you've got to ignore a whole bunch of items in order to get what you want, but ignoring them requires paying attention to them, right? You have to see, oh, Honey Nut, no. Multigrain, no. Regular Cheerios, yes. So you're actually processing all this stuff that you're attempting to ignore because that's part of the operation of ignoring. So you're encountering all this information that you have to filter out. So maybe you think, well, I can't keep up with things at work anymore. At least I have some of my leisure time, but we have less and less leisure time than we did. In the last 10 years, I don't know if you've read about this, have any of you ever heard of shadow work? Shadow work refers to a kind of a gray economy, a shadow economy, that in that we're all doing things that used to be done for us by people who got paid to do them. So in the last 10 years, we're now pumping our own gas. We're scanning our own products at the store. This used to be a profession. You used to be a gas station attendant. That was a profession. In some areas, it was unionized. You know, this was something that somebody got paid for. Somewhere along the line, we started pumping our own gas, not in Oregon, but and we're not getting paid for it. We're not saving any money. They're not charging any less because we're out there doing it. Same with the scanning of the groceries. You make your own airline reservations now. That was a profession. You were a travel agent, right? That was a big deal if you were a travel agent. You had training. Now all of us are asked to do that, and I haven't seen the airlines charging me any less. And so this is called shadow work because we're working on average 5 hours a week doing stuff that used to be done for us. We're not getting paid to do it, and it doesn't contribute to the GNP or the GDP, right? So it's this kind of weird gray economy. And I don't know about you, but I've become now the accounts payable for a number of large multinational corporations who no longer send me a bill. I have to log into their website to find out how much I owe them every month and then arrange for some kind of a payment. So I'm now the accounts payable department. And believe me, I'm not saving any money. So maybe you're thinking that you feel like you don't have as much time as you used to. These are some of the reasons why. And just one last point about information overload. You get home at the end of a hard day. You think, well, I can't keep up with anything at work. I'm falling irretrievably behind on the home chores, and the bills are stacking up. I'm just going to relax and watch an hour of YouTube video. At the very least, I can keep up with what's going on in the world of YouTube. But what you should know is that for every hour that you sit and watch YouTube, there are 6,000 new hours of YouTube videos being uploaded. 6,000 hours of video being uploaded to YouTube every hour. So every hour that you watch, you're already 5,999 hours behind. To a neuroscientist, the definition of information overload is when your brain is encountering more information than it can process. And it really feels like that's what we're facing today. And so what I want to describe are some ideas that I write about in the book. I realized that neuroscience has learned a whole lot in the last 5 years, in particular, about how the brain works, about why the brain pays attention to some things and forgets other things. And most of that information hasn't trickled down to the average person. Even if you read Scientific American and the New York Times Tuesday Science section, we're not, most of us, getting that information. But it's information that would be very helpful. It's information that can help us to solve problems like making big decisions. There are strategies for making big decisions that, especially in an age of information overload, that are based on principles of neuroscience, which I'll get to in a few minutes. And little things like losing our car keys, misplacing our glasses, forgetting where we put our passport. There are some principles that come out of neuroscience for this. Trying to be productive and efficient at home and in the workplace and in your social life. So I want to talk about a few of those principles in the time that we have this evening. And I would say the most important one of them is called externalizing. That is, try to get things out of your head and out into the world and let the environment help you remember things. So an example of that is if you hear on the weather report that it's going to rain tomorrow, of course that's a pretty good bet around here, and you want to remember to bring your umbrella, rather than trying to make a mental note, remember it, and cluttering your head with this among all the other things you're trying to think of, take the umbrella out of the closet, hang it on the front doorknob, right? And now the environment is reminding you, when you leave the house, there's the umbrella. It's doing the reminding for you. And there are many ways we can do this in our daily lives. People complain that they lose their car keys. This is a very typical complaint. Why is this? Well, over tens of thousands of years of evolution, our brains evolved a structure that's exquisitely sensitive to place. It's the seat of place memory in the human brain. It's deep inside. It's a name that you've probably all heard. It's called the hippocampus. The hippocampus is your spatial memory. It's the same part of the brain that you may have read about some years ago that's enlarged in London taxicab drivers. Right? London's very difficult to navigate. In order to get a cab license in London, you need to pass this special test. It's called the knowledge. People study for this for years. And what they found was that the act of studying and learning to navigate all these one-way and dead-end streets that are not on a grid in London, being able to do that requires that this structure, spatial memory, hippocampus, expand in the brain. And, you know, neuroimaging studies have shown that that's what happens. It's the same part of the brain that allows squirrels to find their nuts. Now, if you thought that squirrels were finding them based on smell, they've done the experiment where they denosify squirrels. They don't cut off their noses, but they cut off the pathway of smell to the brain, and the squirrels still find the nuts because they've got exquisite spatial memory. So think back 10 or 20,000 years to our ancestors. The kinds of things they remembered and the hippocampus was important for were things that didn't move around. They were in one place. Where's the location of the well? Where's the location of that stand of fruit trees? Where's the location of that enemy tribe that is vicious and we need to avoid them? Things that didn't move around, the hippocampus is very good at. Not so good at things that move. Just didn't evolve that way because it wasn't necessary. So the problem with things like car keys is that if you set them, or reading glasses for that matter, is if you set them down at a different place in the house every time you set them down, your hippocampus can't help you. So the solution to this is simple, right? What is it? Right, a designated place. Now, you saw this in the movie Dr. Zhivago, right? There's or even in the Big Bang Theory. How many of you watch the Big Bang Theory? You know, when Leonard, the TV show, when Leonard and Sheldon come into their apartment, they've got a nice console table by the front door, big bowl. The keys go in there immediately. Or a hook by the door. Little thing, seems obvious, but most people don't do it. Same with your reading glasses. If you have a designated place for them and they always go there, then of course they'll always be there and it's easy to remember because your hippocampus kicks in. Externalizing memory. So one example is using the environment to remind you of things. Another thing that is very important is writing things down. Writing evolved about 5,000 years ago, and it seems to have evolved at all different in all different cultures around the world at about the same time. We don't know how this happened, but the important thing is that writing externalizes our memory. It also externalizes our planning and scheduling centers in our brain, so we don't have to keep this stuff in our head. Attention is a limited capacity resource. This we've known since the 1950s. Any of you who had an introductory psychology class, you remember hearing about the work of Neville Morey, Colin Cherry, Ann Treisman. They used to call it the cocktail party problem. How does somebody follow a conversation in a room with all these conversations going on? Appears to be an attentional filter. There's an attentional focus. The bottom line is that we used to think you could pay attention to 9 things at once. Turns out that that was a gross overestimate. In most cases, you can pay attention to about 2 or 3 things at a time. And what happens with most of us, at least with me, is that when I'm working on something or spending time with somebody or immersed in a hobby, there's all this chatter, like remember to pick up the dry cleaning, check and see if we need more milk, you've got to mail these letters, remember to call back Aunt Millie, she left 3 voicemails and you haven't called her back yet. Don't forget you have to start work on the Penske file tomorrow at work. All these things are filling up your brain and they're competing for neural resources. They're competing at a biological level for limited resources with what's right in front of you. Whether what's right in front of you is a loved one that you're trying to pay attention to or engage with, whether it's a sport or a hobby you're engaged in, or whether it's your work. And so the most important strategy for dealing with the inner information overload and its nexus with the external information overload is to just write things down. The efficiency guru David Allen, author of the Getting Things Done books, recommends something called the mind-clearing exercise. This is where once a day, more or less often, depending on how much chatter you have up here, you just write down everything that's in your head. And then there's a crucial step. Writing it down isn't enough, although it helps. I mean, your brain is smart. It knows once you've written it down that it can stop reminding you about it, and that allows you to really focus on what's in front of you without distraction. But the next step is, having written it down, prioritize everything. Put them in some kind of an order. So I've had the opportunity in preparing the research for this book to talk to a lot of really successful people who shared with me their strategies, Nobel Prize winners, members of the Obama White House, members of presidential cabinets and generals. And I spoke to the chief logistics officer for the Iraq War, the admiral who was in charge of getting more than 1 million pieces of equipment, separate pieces of equipment to Iraq, and get them there at exactly the right time when 100,000 troops would be there and you know, sort all that out. I talked to artists and musicians, heads of companies, and what I was astonished to find was that many of them use a very low-tech solution to keeping track of things and to-do lists. They use 3x5 index cards. Even Sheryl Sandberg, right, at Facebook, writes in her book that she doesn't like electronic to-do lists. She likes writing them down, which in Silicon Valley, people look at her like she's carrying around a stone tablet and chisel. But it's the thing that works for a lot of people. And the beauty of the index cards is that once you write down all the stuff, you can put them in some physical order. And you might change your mind during the day or during the week. Something else becomes more important. You just move it up. Harder to do if you have a typed list. Not impossible. But the point is, it doesn't really matter what you do. Whatever works for you is fine. But if you get it out of your head and onto a list and prioritize it, here something miraculous starts to happen. You become more immersed in the moment. You become more engaged with what you're doing. You reach this kind of Zen state of being in the moment for a very good reason. I think many of us, when we show up at work, we end up working on whatever we left off on the night before, or whatever happens to be on our desk, or whatever new email came in. We're not very deliberate about it. And I'm curious to know, how many of you have had this experience? You're sitting at your computer, you're working on something, and you start thinking, maybe I should be doing something else. Maybe there's something else I should be doing right now. And you're questioning the commitment that you have to this thing that's right in front of you. If you go through this exercise of writing down everything that's in your head, everything you have to do, work stuff, home stuff, social stuff, chores, you prioritize them, what happens is that whatever is on the top of the list, you do that. And by definition, it's the most important thing you could be doing. And you find yourself immersed in it because your mind isn't trying to find something else to do. With one exception. We're an easily distracted species. This is not an evolutionary accident. We're dealing with brains that evolved to deal with the world the way it was 10 or 20,000 years ago. By some estimates, 50,000 years ago, there's this concept you may have heard of called evolutionary lag. It takes a while for changes in the environment and the way we live to become encoded in the genome, and that lag can be tens of thousands of years. So if you think back to our hunter-gatherer ancestors, 10, 20,000 years ago, there wasn't a whole lot of new stuff going on, right? I mean, there was the, we harnessed fire. 10,000 years go by, we invent the wheel. 10,000 more years, we have agriculture. Not a lot of new stuff going on. Occasionally, a new predator or a new person would walk into your life. But life was moving very slowly. These days, things are moving very quickly. It used to be in our grandparents' generation, they might have had to learn to use, you know, when they were kids, they'd learn to use the telephone once in their life. Now, there's a new update or new software or a new phone every 2 or 3 years. And my poor grandparents are trying to keep up with, you know, all these changes. And that's just in one little thing, one little domain. So the point is that we're not adapted to the rapidity of change. What we evolved over evolutionary timescales was a chemical mechanism that rewarded our ancestors who paid attention to new things. Because new things were likely to be important to them, so important that they needed to really pay attention to them and remember them. New things could be a matter of life or death. They were uncommon. It was a good strategy. And so natural selection favored those of our ancestors who enjoyed learning new things via the mechanism was a little shot of dopamine, the feel-good hormone in the limbic system of the brain. Learn something new, get a shot of dopamine. Learn something else new, get a shot of dopamine. This system worked really, really well for a long time. Now, however, with the internet, there are all these shiny new objects, virtual and real, in our lives that attract our attention, many opportunities to learn new things or read a new email or read a new Facebook post or a new tweet, and our dopamine system rewards us with each new thing to our detriment. We get into a kind of a dopamine addiction loop. I have a solution for it, but I just want to demonstrate how powerful it can be. Again, those of you who took introductory psychology may remember hearing about an experiment done in the 1950s. Happens to have been done by my colleague Peter Milner, who is in his 90s and still comes into work at McGill every day. Back in the 50s, he did a study with rats. Previous research had led him to believe that the reward mechanisms in the brain were located in a particular area called the nucleus accumbens, deep inside the brain, and that reward was modulated by dopamine. And what he did was he wired up rats in a cage with a little electrode, and if they pressed the bar in their cage, they'd get a tiny electric shock that would activate this pleasure center and release dopamine. What do you think the rats did? They pressed the bar over and over and over again to the exclusion of eating and drinking and mating. You could put a very attractive rat of the opposite sex in the cage, and they had no interest. They just pressed the bar over and over again until they died of exhaustion. And if that compulsive, that's how powerful the dopamine addiction loop is. If that compulsive pressing of the bar reminds you of somebody checking their email over and over again, or maybe, oh, I made a Facebook post 20 minutes ago. How many people have liked it since 30 seconds ago? How many thumbs up have I gotten in the last 30 seconds? If that reminds you of that, it's the same thing, right? So what's the solution? I think the solution is exercising just a little bit of discipline and sheltering ourselves from the distractions. We intuitively do this when we're driving, and you might have the radio going and the kids in the back seat, and you're carrying on a conversation with somebody. Maybe you're surreptitiously looking at text messages, even though it's illegal. You've got the GPS on. Now you have to find a parking place in downtown Seattle at 5 o'clock. What do? You turn the radio down. You shield yourself from the distraction because you know you have to concentrate. We can do this. There are programs. There's a Chrome, Google Chrome plugin. There are other programs that will prevent you from going to certain websites. I'm not mentioning any in particular, Facebook, but they'll prevent you from going to these sites for a certain period of time or from spending more than a certain amount of time on them. They really are addictive. Now, I'm not saying that you shouldn't do social media. That's not the message. I'm just saying there should be a time and place for it. Schedule it into your day, into your priorities. Same with email. It's very powerful if you schedule a time of day or two or three times a day where you're going to do email and set a time limit. Sort of train the people in your work and social environment that you're not going to be instantly available. If they want to have a cup of coffee with you 5 minutes from now, email's not the best way to reach you. Move them over to text messages, or God forbid, they call you on the phone and say, let's get together, and or drop by. Drop by, you know, if it's a coworker, they could drop by and say, let's get a cup of coffee. People don't do that. People over 30 don't do that. It's all about email. Under 30, they don't use email anymore. That's an old people's medium, and they don't understand why we're still using it. But just blinkering ourselves, sheltering ourselves from the distractions is very, very helpful. And increasingly, we're seeing this in high-tech companies. It's an interesting throwback to the 1980s in corporate America, where there would be a productivity hour. Don't call me. Don't come by my office. This is my productivity hour. It's very powerful. So take an hour or two off. Train people that you're not going to be available all the time. The combination of these things, of exercising a little bit of self-discipline about when you're going to do these things, and prioritizing your day, really allows for greater creativity and spontaneity in your life. This, according to the people who do this, very highly successful people. I call them HSPs in the book, highly successful people. Why? Because when you're out at dinner with somebody, that's the time you're with them, right? You've designated that as the most important thing you should be doing, and you're not texting the people that you're not at dinner with, and you're not trying to catch up with your emails. You're really fully there and fully present. And I think that one of the reasons we feel so overwhelmed is that many of us are not really any place fully. When we're at work, we're thinking about being at home. When we're at home, we're thinking about all the stuff we didn't get done at work. When we're with friends, we're thinking about the friends we're not with. And I don't think that's any way to live. I think we can recapture that sense of limitless possibility, creativity, and serendipity if if we just follow these simple, really tiny, low-tech self-discipline steps. And as I say, they're based on some neuroscience, getting away from the dopamine newness addiction, also trying to reduce stress in our lives. You hear a lot about stress. There's a neurochemical basis for this. There's a chemical called cortisol, the stress hormone, and when that's released in your brain, a number of things happen. One is that it modulates adrenaline, your heart rate increases, your respiration rate increases, and logical thinking goes out the window. Because in evolutionary timescales, cortisol would be released primarily when you were facing a foe and you had to fight or flee. And when you are in a situation where there's a lion or an angry warrior next to you, you don't have time for logical thinking. You have to work on instinct. You don't have time to digest your food either. That shuts down when you're stressed and when cortisol is released. One reason why people with stress have indigestion and can get ulcers. There's a bacterial cause of ulcers too, but as you know, stress and ulcers are correlated. So reducing stress through being more deliberate, I think, is a big help. Maybe all of you are doing this all anyway, but I think there's room in our lives to become a little bit more focused and a little bit better. It's not that I'm imagining a world of Spock-like automatons that are going from activity to activity with rigidity. What I'm talking about is if you actually prioritize and immerse yourself in the things you're doing at the end of the day, you won't have gotten everything done, but you'll feel this tremendous relief that at least you got done the most important things by definition because you prioritized them. I want to talk about two last things, and then I'd like to open it up to questions. One is multitasking. Turns out multitasking is a myth. We think that we're doing a whole bunch of things at once, and we're not. The brain just doesn't work that way. There's work by Earl Miller at MIT and many others that show that when we think we're doing all these things at once, what's really happening is the brain is rapidly shifting from this to this to this, and then coming back around. You're fractionating your attention into little itty-bitty bits, and that releases cortisol. It causes information to go into the wrong part of the brain, into procedural memory instead of memory for knowledge and facts. And it also causes you to be less efficient. A number of workplace studies now have shown that multitaskers, although they think they're getting more done, at the end of the day, they've gotten less done than unitaskers, people working on one thing at a time. And the unitaskers' work is rated as being of higher quality and as more creative. So why is it the multitaskers think they're getting more done? Well, I can tell you as a neuroscientist, there's one thing the brain is really good at, and that's self-delusion. That's all there is. So, in fact, the entire left hemisphere, my colleague Mike Gazzaniga, who studies split-brain patients, he's characterized the entire left hemisphere as the great confabulator. So you can't trust your own intuitions about this kind of thing. The last thing I wanted to talk about is the role of serendipity in scholarship and in life. It used to be that the way we would acquire information was very inefficient, right? If you wanted to know something, whether it was trying to remind yourself of what the Krebs cycle is from your high school biology class, or you can't remember the speed of light, or you want to know how many moons Jupiter has, or you want to know, Johnny Depp's birthday or how many films he's been in. All of this stuff was out there 20 years ago, 25 years ago, but to acquire the information took a certain amount of time. When I was a kid studying the library, and I was very lucky to have a good public library and a good university library when I went to school, hundreds of thousands of books, I wasn't distracted. It's not like I had to look in every single book that was there because it took too much time. If I wanted to know some little fact, you know, just something pops in my head and I want to know the answer, it would take a while to figure it out, right? I'd have to go to the card catalog. It would send me to a book. That would probably be the wrong book. I'd be in the general vicinity. I'd find the right book, but then I had to find the right page. This could take things that used to take us anywhere from hours to weeks or even months if you had to go to some far-flung archives or find some expert and hope that you could get them on the phone or write them a letter longhand, right? These kinds of things are now available to us instantly. And if you go shopping for a book, it used to be, and still, I mean, if you go into a physical bookstore, the beauty of it is that you've got to walk by other books on the way to the one you're looking for most of the time, right? Occasionally there's books at the front of the store that you want, but you're passing other things, and that's the great thing about physical libraries. I can't tell you how many times that I and many of my colleagues have told, you know, have had the experience that walking across the stacks to get to the book you want, something else catches your eye, and it turns out to be even more interesting and perhaps more relevant than the thing you were actually trying to get. And this happens in bookstores. It happens less with the internet, right? The internet has gotten a little bit too good. One of the great promises of the internet was that it would expose us to ideas that we might not otherwise encounter. Now, I believe that this is the foundation of a free society, that a democracy, one of the great things about democracy is free speech, particularly our democracy here in the United States. We value free speech greatly, so much so that we permit all kinds of speech that is distasteful or ugly, and in some cases even hateful, and in some cases even wrong. We allow people to say things that we know are untrue because we so greatly value free speech. Just look at some of what the presidential candidates are saying, right? We know that a lot of it is untrue. We allow it. But one of the things that's happened, I visited Google not long ago, and I gave a talk there, and some of the engineers told me that what Google's been doing, you probably know this, but if you don't, when you do a Google search, Google knows what computer you're logging in from, and they effectively know who you are, unless you're using a different computer every time. They get to know your search pattern, even if you haven't logged in. And so because they want to provide you with what you're looking for quickly, remember, when Google first came out, whatever you were looking for, it might have been 10 items down on the list. Now it tends to be in the first two or three. It's giving you different results than it's giving you. And those are different results than it's giving you for the exact same search because it knows what you're looking for. And so that means you're less likely to encounter new ideas, less likely to encounter things that might be true or that might be interesting to you but are outside of this little narrow comfort zone. So what, and I find this extends not only to Google search, well, and the other search engines, they're all trying, but to Google Maps, right? Google Maps tells me the most direct and efficient way to get from here to here. Well, if I'm late for a meeting, that's what I want. But if my wife and I are going out for a dinner on a Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, maybe I don't want the most efficient way. Maybe I want the scenic route. I want Google Maps to have a serendipity button or a scenic button. In fact, I want Google to have a serendipity button. I don't always want exactly the thing I'm looking for. I want to see some stuff that's maybe challenging the views I already hold. That's the foundation of a democracy. I mentioned this to the Google people, and, well, they couldn't have rolled their eyes any farther in the back of their heads. They just thought this was crazy talk. And I'd actually like to see a serendipity button on Amazon, right? Kind of like hyperspace on the old Asteroids game, right? I mean, I want to be blown out into some weird corner that's kind of tangentially related. I think that serendipity is important because when you look at the great discoveries in scientific history, the double helix is one of them, came to them in a dream. One of them, was it Crick or Watson? I think it was Crick. Anyway, had a dream about the snakes intertwining and came up with the double helix structure of DNA. And you look at great works of art, these are products of serendipitous encounters, and I think those are important to have and important to recognize them when they happen. And so I think you're very fortunate here in Seattle. We're all fortunate to have a great bookstore like Elliott Bay. This is a dying institution. I love Amazon. I love Elliott Bay. They serve very different functions. I don't see them as competitors. I see them as providing very different experiences. And I think it's something to be treasured because the local independently owned bookstores are going the way of the dodo bird, unfortunately. We need to support them. With that, I'd like to just conclude by saying anything you can do to externalize your processes, to get them out there in the world, is a good way to manage information overload. Anything you can do to kind of filter or restrict the flow of what's going on is also helpful. I'm sure you've had the experience that you're working on something on your computer and you're thinking, I don't really know what to put here. I need to go out to the internet to find this little thing. So you open your browser and you find this thing, and then you think while you're there, boy, I got the browser open. I haven't checked Facebook in a while. Might as well check Facebook. And then, you know, Twitter, Vine, Tumblr, Instagram, Pinterest, Snapchat. You know, 2 hours have gone by, and right? I'm not saying you shouldn't do that. I'm just saying it's helpful to be deliberate about it. I mean, to recognize when you're doing it and put systems in place so that you've got a designated time when you're going to do that, and it just doesn't intrude on your day. You, each of you, should be in charge of how you spend your time, not just the, you know, the shiny objects that are dangling in the internet universe. So thank you very much for hosting me here, and I look forward to hearing your questions.
Good evening, Dr. Levitin. I have had a curiosity over the last 20 years that you might be able to solve for me, which is I take notes longhand, and in meetings I write down things, and I frankly never look at the documents again, but I remember them. But if I do this with my computer and I take notes on my computer, I can't remember them at all. Is that a neurological
Can
thing?
Can I take you around with me to all of my talks on tour? This is such a great question. It turns out that the act of writing things down longhand requires deeper cognitive processing than the act of typing them. And so people who write notes down longhand often find they don't need to refer to the note. People who type things find that they still have to get back to it. And this is true even of digital natives. It's the way the brain is wired up. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Hi.
Did you two just negotiate that you'd get to cut in line?
I was first. Sorry. I was just sitting down, so that's the New Yorker in me.
You were first in your mind. She was first in line, but you were first in... You had the intention to go up.
Your right hemisphere was not watching this whole thing of what's happening. Okay, I have a question about multitasking. You mentioned earlier that multitasking is pretty much impossible, but aren't there certain things that we are actually doing automatically, like driving sometimes, riding a bike, things of that sort?
I'd like to take you with me on tour as well, if you would come. There's a special case here. Neuroscientists call this automaticity, which is just jargon for things that you can do without thinking about them. So when you, and those kind of are not exceptions to the rule of multitasking, but they don't count because they're not using up attentional resources when they become automatic. An example is driving. When you first learned to drive, you were thinking all the time, I got to use this foot, I got to not use this foot unless I, you know, have a clutch, and I've got to check my rearview mirror every 5 seconds, and I got to do this and this. It's very, very demanding to drive when you're a young driver. But now, for most of us, most of the time, we don't have to think about it, which is why you can listen to the radio or carry on a conversation. But as soon as something goes wrong in front of you, or if you're looking for a parking place or trying to find an exit or something, you need to bring all your attention to it. Playing a musical instrument, and acting, so much of what performing artists learn to do is to make these things become automatic. And, you know, a young actor may think, okay, I'm going to walk 7 steps precisely towards the table. When I get there, I'm going to turn left. I'm going to look out here. I'm going to grab the water. But an accomplished actor who's fully in the experience of acting and being in the role, this just is automatic, right? They're in character. This is what's happening. And, of course, that's what you aspire to as a performing artist, especially in music. Not everybody gets there. These things are automatic, and so you can do other things when you're doing these. But if something disrupts the automatic process, you absolutely have to have all your attentional wits about you. So gardening is an example. You can garden and listen to an audiobook or listen to the radio because most of what you're doing in gardening is repetitive and it doesn't require any much thinking. But of course, if you have to stop and read the directions on the back of the packet of seeds, or you know, you've got some anomaly in front of you, then you need to put all your attention there.
Hi, Dr. Levitin. I am an Indian classical musician myself, and I've read your book, This Is Your Brain on Music.
Oh, you're the one.
I like that book, yes.
Thank you.
I happen to agree with most of what you said today, and I do some of that. It does help. But I have a question about serendipitous encounters that you mentioned. How do you actually escape the process of cognition and analysis and, to some extent, intellectualizing and actually hit those creative encounters more often? I have them once in a while, but how do you make that happen more often?
I guess I don't see being cognitively engaged and aware as being separate from serendipitous encounters or from being creative. So serendipity requires being open to experiences. So when you're walking down the street, rather than, you know, thinking hard about something and grumbling about some problem you're having, just, you know, take in the world around you. If you're sitting next to somebody, introduce yourself and, you know, begin a conversation. A conversation may not go anywhere, but it might. You may never want to see the person again, but you might. I gave a book talk in San Diego for This Is Your Brain on Music 9 years ago, and a woman and a man who didn't know each other were sitting next to each other, and they got to talking, and they're married now.
So it could happen.
Now, creativity is a separate thing, perhaps. It requires not always logical thought. It requires making connections between things that are not otherwise seen as connected. In fact, I might argue that a lot of creativity requires nonlinear thinking, that what we certainly what we judge as being creative, as consumers of creative acts and creative arts, what we judge as creative in painting and sculpture and dance and music and theater is when we're shown a connection between two or more things that we hadn't seen before, implying that the artist somehow made a connection between things that weren't connected before. That could be a pretty good definition of what's necessary for something to be art as opposed to just a commercial product, right? So I think this kind of nonlinear thinking, the serendipitous connections, come from a different mode of the brain, a different mode of attention. So forgive me for the digression, but this is really interesting. I talk about it in the book, but I don't mind giving away information for free. That's as it should be. The brain has two main modes of attention. There's actually four altogether, but I want to talk about two. One of them is when, you all recognize this, when you're focused on something, you're engaged, you're not distracted. We call this the central executive mode. It's governed by dopamine in the frontal lobes. Yes, the same thing that's the feel-good hormone in the nucleus accumbens is the attentional hormone in the, when it's in the prefrontal cortex. That's the central executive mode. You're at work, you're in a hobby, you're undistracted, everything's going great. There's this other mode that we call the daydreaming mode. You know this. It's when you're sitting on a beach sipping a martini or a Mai Tai. It's when you're just staring out the window, you're listening to music, and you lose your sense of time and place. Daydreaming mode. It's a different mode. It involves a different set of neural circuits. The daydreaming, the central executive is when you're controlling your thoughts and you're sort of moving one to the next in a deliberate way. The daydreaming mode is you're not controlling your thoughts. They're sort of meandering along some crazy curvy path. They're taking you, and you're not really in control. We call it daydreaming because it's really like night dreaming, where you're not in control. And it's in this daydreaming mode that great creativity can happen. If you're not in control of your thoughts, and they're meandering from one to another, this is where you can discover connections between things you hadn't seen as connected before. This is where your unconscious is taking control, and you know things are percolating up. And many, many times, I'm sure you've all had the experience that you were trying to figure out the answer to some problem, you finally give up, and then later it comes to you. That's the daydreaming mode doing its work. So I think the problem many of us have in the workplace is that we'll be working for an hour or two, and our attention will start to flag. especially if you're working on something hard and you think, oh, it's just you notice your mind wandering, and so you reach for another cup of coffee. But what your brain is trying to do is to tell you, I need some mind wandering time. And it's a restorative mode. It's such a fundamental and important mode of thinking that its discoverer, Marcus Raichel, at Washington University in St. Louis, calls it the default mode of the brain. It's the default mode. It's where your brain wants to go. So the next time you feel your attention flagging, follow your brain's advice. Let your brain wander for a while. You know, there have been a number of studies on this. People that allow this, you know, that practice a kind of work cycle of maybe an hour and a half or two of focused attention, 15 minutes or so of a break. And I mean a real break, not an internet surfing break, but, you know, exercise, immersing yourself in nature, reading literature, listening to music. That kind of a break is really restorative. It restores used up chemicals in the brain that were expended through deliberate thought. Tremendously helpful. Well, for one thing, it restores glucose. It resets glucose levels in the brain. Naps are even better. If you can take a 15-minute nap in the afternoon, this can be the equivalent of an extra hour and a half of sleep the night before. So, thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Yes. You waited so patiently.
I have two nieces who are 10 and 12, and when I think... Oh, can you hear me?
She has two nieces who are 10 and 12.
10 and 12. And when I think of what they're exposed to and what they were exposed to as children or what we're exposed to, changes of scene, changes of color in toys or in television or anything else, scenes like change, color and exposure. And I mean, it's no wonder it seems that people have increased ADHD. And I'm wondering, like, I don't think it's increased reporting of this in the way that I think a lot of people talk about depression or anything else being increasingly reported. I think no wonder they're having trouble. Like, no one can sit for 2 hours and read Moby Dick. This is a huge change in how brains develop, and I'm wondering how you see that and how successful, like, how that changes. Who is successful and what kinds of things are successful in the way that children interpret the world?
So it's true. The younger generation of kids, say kids under 20 now, kids and young adults under 20, are accustomed to very fast edits in the videos they watch, very rapid changes in where they focus their attention. They're able to do a lot more things than we're able to do. They understand these things natively. I don't want to generalize, but a number of students that I see, you know, as a university teacher, I see a new crop of 17 and 18-year-olds every year. And we just brought in a new crop of students, of course, in September. And a number of them came and asked to meet privately with me and express some concern when they looked at their class schedule and the homework schedule. You know, we say, well, you're going to be in class for an hour, and for every hour that you spend in class, you're going to need to spend 2 hours doing homework. And the concern they expressed was, I've never had to do anything for 2 hours. I'm used to doing things for 10 or 15 minutes and then doing something else. And lots of them expressed this, and I know that it's true. So I think we're doing a disservice to young people by not helping them from an early age to learn to sustain attention and immerse themselves in activities. Now, here's a place where musicians have an advantage, because young musicians are accustomed to practicing for half an hour or an hour. Or I just met a young woman who's a concert pianist at age 16. She's practicing typically 6 hours a day. And so she's very accustomed to doing one thing and getting really deep into it. She's a world-class pianist. Her name, by the way, is Karen Nagano, the daughter of Kent Nagano, the great conductor. And so I'm thinking, you know, at some point, we're all going to be in old age homes. That's our future. Some of us sooner than others. And it's the young people, the people who are young now, who are going to be looking after the world. And when I think about the biggest problems that the world faces, I mean, I don't know. I think on anybody's list would be poverty, hunger, starvation, unequal distribution of resources across the world, terrible aggression across international borders, terrible aggression within countries, infighting, genocides, combating the results of climate change. These are big, big problems that the next generation is going to have to solve. I don't think they're unsolvable. But they're going to take a concerted effort. If they were easy to solve, they would have been solved by now. But I don't think they're going to be solved by somebody thinking about world hunger for about 5 seconds and then doing something else for 5 seconds and something else and then coming back to world hunger. I think they're going to take a sustained effort. And I think anything worth doing takes a sustained effort. I mean, you know, think of the Sistine Chapel, Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, Picasso, Braque, and Gris inventing cubism. These are not things that happen by paying attention to them for 5 minutes or even 40 minutes at a time. So I think our task is to help young people to increase their attention spans gradually from 5 minutes to 10 to 20 to 40 to an hour. And I think that's an investment well made.
Hi, excellent talk. I have a kind of multifaceted question, and I'll let you just answer the part that's most interesting to you.
Oh, good.
I've heard of a technique called the memory palace by which you can force things into the hippocampi by associating eventual, factual, or procedural memory with contrived spatial location. I'm curious about a few things. One, why spatial location is forced into long-term memory when the other types of memory aren't, and probably more curious about whether or not there's an analogous buffer in the brain for non-potentiated memory that allows us to switch context, and whether or not a meditation would help or hurt, or whether there's another technique to kind of increase that buffer for context switching to allow us to be distracted without losing our thought.
I'm going to try to answer this quickly. The memory palace that you refer to goes back to the ancient Greeks. It was made popular most recently by the popular book Moonwalking with Einstein. It's a way to remember very large sets of facts or numbers or concepts. It works. We don't know exactly why it works, but I'll tell you the two biggest tips that I have for improving memory are, and I'll take just one question after this, right?
Yeah.
The two biggest tips are getting a good night's sleep and using spaced versus massed practice. Why a good night's sleep? We've just begun to understand in the last few years, based largely on the work of Robert Stickgold and others, that sleep, the process of sleep releases acetylcholine in stages prior to the REM state, and acetylcholine helps to prepare information that you obtained during the previous day for memory storage. And if you disrupt your sleep cycle or you don't get enough sleep, the memory storage is disrupted. And you can see the effects of this up to 3 weeks after the bad night's sleep. The other part about spaced versus mass practice builds upon this. Matthew Walker is another sleep researcher, UC Berkeley, who's uncovered some of this work. The idea of spaced versus mass practice is if you're trying to learn a new skill, whether it's playing a musical instrument or an athletic skill, or just learn a new set of facts, you want to space out your rehearsal time rather than clumping it. So in the musical case, suppose you want to practice the piano for 6 hours on a Sunday. That's going to be less effective than practicing just 20 minutes a day for 7 days, where you're doing it every single day a little bit, because it's the sleep in between the days of practice that's helping to buoy the learning. You don't get that if you do it all in one afternoon once a week. So those are the big tips for improving memory.
So my question sort of touches on the previous question that was from this corner, but we know that...
You've got corner-specific memory.
Corner-specific memory. The stimuli that children these days are exposed to is vastly different from what older generations were exposed to, and the way people learn as children these days is very different from that as well. We also know a hot topic in medicine right now is neuroplasticity and knowing that exposures can influence the way the brain is structured. Are there any studies that suggest that the neural structures of the younger generation differs completely or in any way from older generations?
I have not seen any studies that show that the brains of the younger generation are different than they were in a previous generation, but here's why. We've only had neuroimaging technology for about 20 years, so we don't have images of the brains of children of the previous generation. We only have the ones now. So I think that's the big hurdle to understanding this. it's possible that the brains are developing differently, maybe even probable. But because of neuroplasticity, the idea that the brain can change itself, in fact, you know, to a neuroscientist, that's what learning is. The brain changing itself is what learning is. It's just a different level of analysis or a different way of looking at it. So we expect those changes, and the brain is very adaptable. So I think we're all in good hands. I think the next generation is going to be fantastic. The people who are under 20 are going to make the world a better place. I think they're going to manage to solve a lot of the world's big problems and take care of all of us when we're in our dotage. So I'd like to give a hand to the younger generation, to your children and grandchildren. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for listening to this extra episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. You can find out more in Daniel Levitin's book, The Organized Mind, Thinking Straight in the Age of Information Overload. He spoke at Town Hall Seattle on September 11th, 2015. Join us soon for another episode of Speakers Forum.